You're listening to Future Artifacts FM, a bi-monthly podcast and broadcast featuring speculative fiction audio works by artists and writers, produced and presented by Nina Davies,
Rebecca Edwards,
and Niamh Schmidtke on RTM,
and also available wherever you get your podcasts.
The program focuses on fictional works intended for broadcast to carve out a better understanding of the now by exploring various interpretations of the future.
Together with guests, we discuss the mechanics of different types of storytelling to reveal the complexities of contemporary culture. Let's get started.
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 Okay, welcome back to Future Artifacts FM. For this episode, you are just joined by your hosts, Nina Davies,
Rebecca Edwards,
and Niamh Schmidtke. We're going to be doing a recap episode today of our mini-series As a Chorus, as it's just been completed.
Yeah, I know. We've had four artists on the episode, on the series, starting with our lovely Niamh Schmidtke.
Yeah, which I realised was way back in October. Was it October? September?
Yeah, it feels like quite a while ago. And it's quite funny because the piece from that was made last summer and is now going to a show this summer.
Okay.
So it's like almost the whole life cycle has happened in between.
Yeah.
And some of the conversations we've had on this radio show on this miniseries have been quite helpful in figuring out the work too.
Oh, that's great.
But I think that's sort of an ongoing theme across the radio show as well, is that we're always being inspired and influenced by the various people and themes that we have on the show.
Like, which is very fitting for what we're going to talk about today.
Yeah.
So we had our the second artist on the miniseries was Most Dismal Swamp, aka Dane Sutherland.
Yeah.
I mean, Most Dismal Swamp is
the artist name.
Is sort of like the collaborative name or the project name, and Dane is sort of the person that oversees.
Collaboration.
I think he described himself as like a creative. He was like
creative
director.
Yeah,
he had these like fictional characters of creative directors, and he was sort of saying that there was something that he was doing that was quite akin to what they do, but it's sort of different.
Quite a murky place.
Yeah,
yeah, in a good
way. Swampy place.
Yeah,
and then we had Reese.
Yes,
Reese Morgan
with the lovely sea shanties, which I'd seen his work at New Contemporaries, which we were both in the same year, and he did a live performance with the sea shanty group. And I remember when I saw it, like this was a few years ago now, and I was like, oh, this would be great to have on the show. And suddenly when Niamh, you proposed this idea for the mini series, I was like, I have just the name.
We know exactly. And then the final episode that we had in this mini series was Emily Roderick, our most recent episode with Can You Call a Touch on bell ringing across the UK, but predominantly England and predominantly around her own family's relationship to bell ringing. Yeah.
In Coventry, I think, near Coventry.
So maybe just before we get into our sort of recap episode, what we thought we'd do is we would read out our sort of statement that we initially wrote out when we were kind of beginning to think about this miniseries. And then what we're going to do is kind of discuss where the miniseries has taken us to. Has it diverted in any way from what our initial questions were, or have we answered any questions? Probably not.
But we're going to unpick it.
Yeah, we've answered questions with more questions.
Yeah, exactly. Cool. Niamh, take it away.
As a Chorus. How does singing tell a story? How are our bodies intrinsic to the expression of pitch, tone, or duration of a note? How do individual voices dissipate into a group of singers, the volume rising from a crowd of chanters, or the controlled unison of trained harmonies in a choir?
How does this perspective translate to artists whose collaborative process goes beyond the baseline level of working together to something more akin to developing together?
For this Future Artifacts miniseries, which we've already completed, we're exploring the types of narratives inherent to songs, music, scores, and group singing. From Greenham Common Songbook to Nina Simone's Mississippi Goddam, singing has long been a form of resistance, both articulating the injustice faced and providing an outlet for the violence of that injustice.
A chorus points to both the group of people who may sing these songs together and the impact the repetition has on its listeners. Singing together has long been used as a tool for synchronization in workspaces, from sea shanties that coordinated sailors' movements to field songs that kept labourers in rhythm. These occupational songs don't just pass the time, they harness the physical power of music to move ships, shape tasks, and unify collective effort.
Yeah, so I think, as you can even see from that first question, how does singing tell a story? I think when we were coming to this mini-series, we were thinking very much about a choir because of your practice, Niamh. So, you know, for sure, I think this idea of singing or choral practice has evolved into a kind of metaphor for thinking more about collective practice in general, right?
Yeah, I think there was also an interest because we haven't really looked at music and song on the radio show at all. There's been soundscapes, but it's much more conversational and spoken rather than here's a group of people singing. And I think this miniseries in particular, well, I'm thinking of the work I showed, but also of Risa's work of Seaweed in the Fruit Locker, and how the song becomes the vehicle for kind of both the group to come together, but also for kind of the narrative, which is not something that I think we've delved into much here. I mean, none of us are musicians. I don't think, can any of us read music?
No. I mean, no, I can't. But I was thinking that it's funny that looking back at all the episodes, or not each episode that we did in the miniseries, but we split up produced each episode a little bit more like a radio show that's like playing tracks where we would play a track in between. And we kind of, I think we did that for everyone but yours, Niamh. And it was sort of, it just very naturally, naturally happened. So even the episodes that weren't necessarily to do with songs, we still kind of broke up in that way. It was sort of very like, it was sort of embedded into the way that we kind of presented the miniseries.
But I think a large part of that was because the things that we were presenting as like these single tracks, they were either research or they were like chapters of a much longer piece of work. Like I'm thinking about Most Dismal Swamp, and we kind of took small sections from a sort of 3-4 hour sort of series of works. And then with Emily, because it was a work in progress, there were interviews with her parents, as well as bell ringing, as well as all of these other things. So I think it did make sense to do it like that. It made the episodes feel more collaborative whilst we were speaking about them as well.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I think the big thing I noticed when we were editing this series also was, naturally, we've always paid attention to credits and credits of works, and we've had many people who've worked with quite specific sound collaborators in the past. But this miniseries, every single artist we've shown, the credits list has been incredibly long.
Yeah.
And I think there's something interesting about that in terms of, you know, technically all art, like an artwork is never made in isolation. You know, this idea of kind of sole authorship in an artwork has been quite thoroughly broken down, especially most recently. I'm thinking of things like the Turner Prize a few years ago, only nominating artist collectives, you know, the Array Collective from Belfast winning that year. But even still, usually when you go into an exhibition space, it's one artist's name as the author, as the author of the work, and then you have the list of credits underneath. And I think obviously we're replicating that in this series as well. Kind of we have an artist's name and the work at the beginning of each episode. But the credits list at the bottom now, most artists, the credits list is minimum 5 names. And these are for quite small bits of sound work. You know, and obviously they're part of quite expansive practices and quite expansive research projects. But even with Reese's episode, you know, each song, there was one song where he had rewritten the lyrics and he was performing it as sort of, let's say, the lead in the choir. But the remaining songs that we played, the remaining shanties that we played, were written by different members of that choir. And were performed by different members of that choir. And I think that was something that really, you know, I'm hoping that we bring forwards into future episodes, and even as we're planning the next mini-series, which is currently in production, there's a similar feeling as well of kind of understanding, okay, how are works made? Like, how does practice form through the groups of people that you're surrounded by?
Mm.
Which I think this miniseries tries to put more, like, direct the light onto.
Yeah, and I was going to say, I think Reese's work is actually a really good example of, like, an artwork that the sea shanty group didn't exist mm-hmm. before the artwork. It then, like, the artwork created this group, and then beyond the artwork, the group has still kind of kept going. It sort of like maintained its structure out. It's become like autonomous, I guess, from the artwork, mm-hmm. which I think is a really interesting kind of way of thinking of working collaboratively. Like, it's something that I haven't necessarily like seen that much.
I think there's like a lifespan. It was, and I think also with Reese's practice and also Emily's practice, there's something around, and I'm thinking about the work that I showed also because I'm currently developing it for something new. There's a question around socially engaged practice, which can be quite contentious because most often when you're an artist, you're not trained in like safeguarding practices, for example, when you're working with a group of people. In the case of the work that I made, I was in a town on residency. It's not my locality. It's not the group of people that I know very well. I'm getting to know them well through doing the project. But part of, in the case of the work that I made, choosing to work with a song that already existed and choosing to work with a singer who was local to the area has meant that when I have later on met people who have heard that song or who saw that performance or listened to the sound work on this radio show, they've sung it back to me. And so I think there's something interesting in that process of collaborative making where you're very explicit about the amount of voices that have gone into making a work that it immediately has a life much bigger than you.
Mm. There's something that I was thinking about in terms of why collective work feels so important or more recognisable now as a thing. And I was trying to think about in previous decades, you know, you had this kind of like the solo artist, the kind of the gallery representation. It would be hard to get gallery representation maybe as a collective over being a solo artist, and thinking about how the sort of creditability or accountability of people's roles within the creation of a work, it's completely shifted now. And I was just thinking, you mentioned social practice there, and I'm not going to name names, but there are definitely groups of artists that I've heard of that are in this kind of social practice area who it's very much extractive, and they're working with people that are not paid for a start, or they're young, or they're, it's kind of like a leg up for them. And I'm wondering if this kind of renewed focus on collaborative work is maybe this idea of safety in numbers as well. It's kind of like a resisting of institutionalization. It's kind of like pushing against being read in a particular commercially viable way in something more like a DIY aesthetic or...
I mean, I think, like, because briefly mentioned about the Turner Prize and the RA Collective and in Belfast, and I think there's quite... I'll start this by saying it's interesting when you speak with artists in Ireland, because many artists in Ireland now, when you talk to them about places they want to live or places that are creatively vibrant, the amount of people that have responded to me with Belfast, I'd love to move to Belfast. It's across the island of Ireland. It's not just in the north. And the thing that's interesting about Belfast, and I'll kind of come back around to talking about the ARIA Collective in terms of why collectives are important, is that it's one of the cities in Ireland where the cost of living has not become astronomical. The price has gone up significantly, but other cities in the country are incredibly hard for artists to continue to live in. Kind of the three largest cities, Dublin, Cork and Galway in particular, many people are being pushed out, or you're living in really substandard accommodation, or you're living with illegal contracts because it's the only way you can afford. I mean, London has this too, right? It's sort of, it's an issue we're all facing globally. With Belfast, that hasn't happened in the same way, partially because of sectarian violence and the troubles and people keeping fear of that. the other thing that happens, that's happening in Belfast and Northern Ireland more generally, access to public funding is really difficult, and there isn't a commercial art sector.
So maybe it is about being part of a collective, taking on tasks as a group. It's much more doable.
You don't have the institutions. You don't have the galleries. You make them. And that's too much for one person to do. So you make a collective. And I think that's like a culture that used to exist much more in London, kind of the artist-run space, which we're seeing shut down all over the city because the cost of living, less access to public funding. And in a city like London in particular, like you can't afford to live here without decent income. And so I think the thing that's interesting about Array Collective is they're a very large group of artists. You know, collectives generally you think are like less than 10 people. Array Collective is, I think, over 50. I'm not going to quote how many people. It's a large group of people, and they form together because they have to, because that's how they create the infrastructure for them to remain being artists.
Yeah, it's sort of about the arts infrastructure being different, rather than like the environment in which they're making within is different, so it calls for that kind of making. Whereas like potentially in London, like, well, I don't know, I don't want to say in London that kind of making like wouldn't make sense, but there's a slightly different way that the art world works in London. That
I think the difference in London is the cost of living is much higher. There's a commercial sector and there's more access to public funding. Even though it's incredibly competitive, there is access to public funding. But like, for example, in Northern Ireland and in Scotland, the public funding for the arts has been slashed so comprehensively that it pretty much doesn't exist.
Yeah, and we've seen closures of spaces like the CCA in Glasgow.
Yeah.
And all of these things as well. But for me, there's something about, if we're talking about collective sort of making of work, I think there's also something that should be said about specifically digital artists who are making work with computational infrastructure, software, hardware, because you physically cannot make that work on your own. And I'm thinking also about, you know, there's not many artists that exist that have skill sets that run from training AI models to programming to Blender to Unity to, you know, all of these different kinds of things that go into making a kind of contemporary digital arts practice. You need collaborators. You physically can't do it on your own unless you're some sort of polymath, which, you know, is quite rare.
And then even if you if you do have those skills, are you going to the schmoozy events?
No,
like,
exactly.
You probably don't have time to like then do the other extra labor that is involved in being an artist and like the stuff that no one wants, like none of us want to do, but you have to do. But if you were doing all these other things, you wouldn't actually physically have the time to fit it in.
Well, then is there a question about the expectation of how artwork is produced now requires collaboration? But that's something slightly different, because then I'm also thinking, so I don't know,
because I think it would be interesting to, well, we were just talking before we started recording about like expanding what collaboration, like the many
like
different forms of like what collaboration can mean. Like, I guess, again, what I don't want to do is like label one thing as good and one thing as bad, but sort of be that like there are multiple ways of collaborating, I guess.
Yeah, but I have a bit of a pet peeve when people say, oh, I'm collaborating with someone, where actually what they're doing is paying them to complete a task for them. So if we're talking about kind of making a digital artwork, for example, generally the artist will have kind of one, potentially two technical kind of sets of tools that they can use in their practice. So they can probably edit video quite competently, and they can come up with the concept very clearly. I mean, that's their role usually. And maybe there's one other type of thing, like they can...
Are we talking about me? And she can do performance.
But then, for example, let's say there's some kind of 3D rendered object in the video. it's a huge ask for an artist to then, who can, let's say, you know, for example, if we're taking your practice, Nina, it's like, you're already a performer, you're already choreographing, you're already editing the video, you're coming up with the concept, so forth. It's a huge ask, then also ask you to be really good at 3D modeling. That takes years. People do 4-year degrees to learn how to 3D model.
Yeah.
But when you're working with a 3D modeler, are you saying, oh, let's have a conversation and let's make a concept together about how this character is going to look? Oftentimes not. Oftentimes you'd probably be going to the person saying, this is the film I want to make and I need this character to do this specific thing at this point. And it probably needs to be about this long. Like, you're hiring someone to complete a job for you. And it, to me, that's not collaboration in the way we're talking about it in this miniseries. And the way we're talking about it in this miniseries is more that there's more of a give and take with the authorship of the work. No one's being told what to do. You're collectively agreeing on what you're doing together. That's kind of why I'm interested in the idea of like a choir, because there is a leader, but you're also actively deciding to be a part or not a part of that bit of voices.
Yeah, it's like we spoke a lot in previous episodes with this miniseries about the lack of hierarchy or the kind of dissolving of agency. Everybody has the same kind of agency within these groups. But I would push against you, Niamh, just a little bit, because I do feel like in some ways, like if I think, I mean, I'm not an artist, I'm a sort of curator, producer, but I would definitely say that work that I've done very recently, I've been a collaborator on, but I feel like perhaps in some ways, because I'm kind of like, I'm paid by these two artists that I've been working with to kind of help produce their show, I feel like I have some agency in it, so I would say that I've been collaborating with them, but the way that the project has been announced is the two artists in collaboration, but I know that I've had creative conversations with them. So I think there's something, maybe we're getting a bit too bogged down with kind of like defining collaboration and collaboration, collective, they're very, very different. But I think the whole thing that we're saying is that the artists in this miniseries, it's more about a lack of hierarchy and a kind of even footing on the creative output.
I don't feel like being paid or not being paid is inherent to it's a collaboration or not. In terms of a few years ago, I worked on a radio play and I worked with a sound designer, and it was it was interesting to have those conversations with him, but I very much approached it with, these are things that I'm interested in, but what are you interested in learning through this process? And then creatively having a conversation about, would it sound like this or would it sound like that? And I think that's, like, he was getting paid for that work, right? That doesn't mean that, like, all of a sudden his collaboration isn't worthwhile because he's getting paid for the work. That doesn't feel like but what you're talking about sounds like a credit issue,
I guess.
In terms of how things are properly credited. And I think I've spoken to other people who are curators and producers of larger projects, and it is really, and I've worked with them myself, and it is this thing of like, oh, but we've had all these conversations and I'm actively a voice in this work. Without my voice being a part of this conversation, the work would be incredibly different. And usually the crediting of that is never done accurately.
Yeah,
and is never done accurately. I mean, really rarely is it done accurately.
But then taking my own logic, it's kind of hilarious, because if you were to go to that extent, you'd be crediting every single writer that you've read a sentence of, or you'd be crediting like Nina, who gave you like a really interesting point on the work. It's like, how far does that actually go?
I think it's interesting, because I think Dane's
work does
Dane
that.
Dane does do that.
Yeah.
Like, Dane does. I remember, like, didn't Chris McInnes, who we've had on the show, Chris McInnes gave Dane like a line that then he ended up using in the film, and still credited Chris like for that, just that one sentence in like a cacophony of sentences that are within the film. So I mean, Dane's probably like a really good like person to, or Most Dismal Swamp is like a really good project to look to, that kind of actually does include, like, it is just everyone is part of it, no matter how big or small the contribution to the project is.
Yeah, it reminds me of the blockchain ledger and kind of making sure that everything is accounted for and that there's something to go back to and say, yes, this happened on this day and this is why I've said this.
Yeah, exactly.
What are your references?
Well, and also Dane takes his name out. Like, it's like, Most Dismal Swamp, like, is everyone who's involved in the project. Everyone who's involved in the project gets credited, and the only person that doesn't get credited, the only name that doesn't get credited, I could be wrong with this, is Dane.
I don't know.
I mean, people kind of know that Most Dismal Swamp is Dane, but...
Yeah, there's something about this anonymity within collectives like the Gorilla Girls and all of these like previous sort of collective collaborative projects where the point was to not be named.
Like, also thinking about Pussy Riot as an artist collective and part of that being, kind of a protection strategy against Russian politics. I mean, not that it protected all of them, obviously, but kind of that process of the collective being a protective space where if several of us carry this voice, which I guess is sort of what unions do, or it's sort of leaning on the idea of what a union might be able to do in terms of together we rise type idea.
But I think, there is that aspect of it as well. But for me, it's like anybody could be in a Most Dismal Swamp project. It makes it feel open because it's got no kind of name, but everyone is credited. So it feels very inviting to me as well, like being an anonymous name. Like, I mean, Dane is just very open and very sweet and kind anyway and whatever, but I think the fact that he's not putting his name at the front and center, it's not obnoxious, it's not kind of ego driven at all, even though I think in his episode he said that a lot of his work is very much driven by his own like pleasure, taking pleasure
and pleasure I would say are two very different things. Because that's just someone enjoying other people's work so much that like they're surrounding themselves with, like, they're finding excuses to surround themselves with other people's work.
No, I think a lot, because I help run a graduate award and quite often end up having conversations with recent graduates about how do you sustain practice. And one of the things that I think is always helpful to come back to is kind of who are the people that you're surrounding yourself with. How do you talk about your practice with them? But also, like, do they make you feel good about the work that you're making? Do you trust they'll call you out if the work is bad and this type of thing? And that's an infrastructure part, because you're sort of still getting to the point where the work might be recognized by someone that you don't know, or it might go into an institution, or you might get a bit of money for it, or you might get a grant, whatever that is, whatever you want the practice to be. And it feels like with Dane's practice, he's found, oh, this is the infrastructure for my practice that makes me want to continue doing it regardless of what external things are happening, in terms of, is it being shown in a specific place, or am I getting funding for this commission, or, you know. And he's a very successful artist, so thankfully from the conversation we had with him, at least, it doesn't seem like it's an immediate pressure on the practice. But in the meantime, he's creating all the systems that would mean he would do it kind of regardless. And I think there's a question of that in terms of making the collective, or like working collaboratively.
Most Dismal Swamp would still exist just on a more low budget. It would still be going regardless of like who's funding it or if anyone's funding it.
And I think, I mean, maybe it was funny when I was thinking about today, I was also thinking about Future Artifacts FM and this project as a collaborative project where there's also, you know, it's gone through different points of kind of funding and reach and so forth, but it always comes back to a point of, well, what do we want to talk about? What do we want to investigate? How do we want to investigate that? Who do we want to bring onto the show? And because of that, it helps ride all of those waves. It's like, well, fundamentally, it's a project that we continue to want to come back. We've created the infrastructure that we work best with. And that means that the external infrastructure can sort of can be more turbulent, perhaps.
Yeah.
Because the internal infrastructure is good.
Yeah.
There's something in there about, so in Dane's episode, he was mentioning model collapse, or Nina, maybe you mentioned it, but this idea that a system fed on its own sort of generated stuff will fall eventually, and that it needs real data input into it to kind of not collapse. So I was thinking about how these collaborative practices and maybe these kind of models, and you know, with Reese, with Dane, even with Emily, like adding new people, adding new ideas, adding new constraints kind of allows them to propel and continue. But what I was wondering about the sort of stability of these practices, and if they only exist when they're enacted, what happens to Most Dismal Swamp, Dane, what happens to Reese, what happens to Emily without collaborators, without this newness being put in, or without this external kind of reference points? Like, do they then become a state of model collapse because they're kind of just existing on their own? They're feeding on one person. Like, I was trying to think, like, basically, would those practices work if it was just one person?
But my response would be, I think most practices don't work if they're one person.
Mm.
As in, like, you wouldn't be able to do what you do if it was just you.
Mm. Mm.
And like, Nina, your practice as well doesn't, like, it also requires the groups of people that you work with.
Yeah, if I didn't have dancers, it wouldn't, yeah.
And as in, that feels like a strength.
Mm.
I understand what you're talking about with the model collapse and things coming new. I guess maybe I'm getting too meta about it, but it feels like that's how many practices operate.
Mm.
You know, it might not be with people, but it would always be with ideas, and people are usually conduits of ideas.
Yeah, you can't make artwork in a vacuum. Well, you can't make anything in a vacuum, maybe.
And that's kind of the thing that's sort of hilarious about the collectives being like, you don't really see collectives getting gallery representation.
That's what I was kind of getting.
Or even if you're applying for a residency, they'll accept a duo.
But they won't accept a collective. Fees, but I think it has more to do with like making sure people are paid.
But yeah, but you get what I mean in terms the whole. Even though we all understand as people working in the creative industry that we require the groups of people, the collectives of people, the communities of people to help sustain our practices and our sanity, to be honest, as well. In terms of how funding infrastructure, institutional infrastructures, and like, let's say art market in like a big, like in the sky version of it, those systems are not built for that.
Well, I guess, it is sort of like with the artwork, the art market being built on like speculation as well. Like suddenly if you put the dynamics of a group working together, which could also not be sustainable, like that, like suddenly that's like
risk,
it's more risk, isn't it? I mean, I don't actually understand how the art market like works, like, but
it's not a hat that any of us wear.
No. I mean, I think it's interesting even because I'm involved in a project with a co-op, and it's sort of about gaining funding for a much larger pot of funding for a really large project, and we've ended up putting in a secondary infrastructure of like a charity with a very specific set of trustees, which is more reasonable for a funder than a cooperative, which is is acting like a collective. It's a much larger group of people. And so even that, those kind of institutional structures of how do you get paid? Mm. How do you pay other people? How do you pay rent? Those types of things. There very few of them are really set up for working collectively or working with larger groups of people or non-hierarchical decision making. You know, artist practices can do that, and usually you'll see collectives running like artist-run spaces quite often because you have to divide the labor. Not one person can do all the tasks, as we said at the beginning. But once you get to a certain level, institutions are not able to apply for the types of money that would need. Like, for example, if Array Collective is showing in an exhibition, is every member of Array Collective getting, £1,000 fee?
Mm.
I don't know. I would assume not.
Yeah, I wonder what happens to collective practice once you get to a point where you're very well known and you're very recognised. Maybe, I don't know, I'm just kind of thinking about what we were saying earlier about paying people to do stuff for you, for your work. Like, if you're all getting to such a level that you're getting paid so well, or that you've got that kind of recognition, I don't know, collectives to me just feel very more grassroots than they do in a kind of like art market level. And I don't know if that's just me being really naive, but I think it is because most of them start in a very grassroots way out of necessity and out of urgency.
Yeah. Like, I'm thinking about Reese's practice and talking specifically about needing more queer spaces where he was living. You know, and thinking about queer spaces being in major cities, but not in smaller cities, not in kind of portside cities, not in Portsmouth. And talking about how, you know, it's become more vibrant and, you know, but that the collective or the community forms sometimes because they're a minority, but more often than not because they need each other, because it's kind of, it's filling a gap
there's
that
some,
people
some
want.
Need or like, yeah.
Yeah, 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 yeah. Like, people want to meet or people want to sing or like whatever the thing is.
Yeah, I was going to, and we're kind of maybe going on to this, but I think in going back to our like initial statement about the As a Chorus, we mentioned about like the power, of course, we were talking about it in songs in our statement, but like the power of, we say songs, to move ships and like what working together is able to achieve, because I feel like we sort of have been talking about like the like how working as a collective functions in the art world, which is interesting to a certain point.
Maybe more for us than
Well, I sort of think, I'm worried that maybe we've been maybe like almost a little bit negative of like how could this work, and like, but I'm also kind of thinking maybe like moving towards the more positive ideas of like how working together. Like, what does it do outside of it existing within the art structure? What does it do? And sort of, I guess, like Reese's example of like this group kind of, you know, making spaces that weren't necessarily queer before suddenly queer friendly, and like where this project, even though it starts as an artwork, it then this group together suddenly are actually like making change. Big or small, doesn't matter what they're doing. And the same with Emily's work with, I mean, again, we're not talking about, like, we're talking about this idea of, like, the church bells kind of ringing after a long hiatus of not having church bells anymore, and the feeling of the village getting its voice back, and suddenly, like, what this sort of, again, like, and it can be working, I feel like in Emily's case, it's not talking about collaborative practice within the art world, is talking about collaborative artistic practice functioning just in the real world, not for art's sake. And maybe kind of thinking about, I don't know, I was just in Helsinki and recording a little like short interview, and someone asked me the question of why are workshops important. And I was like, I haven't got a prepared answer. And I kind of, after I thought about it for a while, I kind of used this example. So I kind of only can ever really use examples of my own work. Mm. You know, I did some workshops in last winter, or like 2 winters ago in Vancouver. And some of the people that I met on the workshops ended up becoming part of my work as performers. And we ended up working on sort of satellite works together that ended up becoming like not part of the show, and ended up becoming collaborative works that have existed outside of my work. That is, and I was think I said something like the best workshops are the workshops that never end, and they just keep, and they kind of just keep going. And in that way, like, I've been able to kind of bring either like younger artists, or artists who maybe are getting, someone who's starting to try art, who's never done it before, kind of bringing them in, giving them their own voice. I don't want to like toot my own horn.
Well, like
here,
the tools, the tools to kind of figure out what they want the voice to be.
Yeah, exactly. So I guess this idea of kind of coming together, and like what can coming together do?
It reminds me of like game jams, you know, where people like make video games together in a very short space of time, and that's a kind of collaborative, it's got constraint to it, but it's all about just working together and learning off each other. I think yeah,
yeah, bringing in different voices, like bringing in different voices, opinions, mm. or experiences.
Mm. Again, I'm just thinking about unions. In terms of like, what do they do? I mean, I saw something online because we very recently had the Easter bank holiday, and saying kind of all bank holidays that you have, all weekends you have, that was a union. Mm, and mm. that's kind of people coming together mm. to try and create conditions that are better for all of us. In terms of, I guess, also like grassroots, what collectives do, or like sort of how groups of people show up together. I mean, that's going in like a broader...
But I guess sort of like what kind of artistic activities that bring people together yeah. can kind of create some sort of change, in the same way of like singing a sea shanty on a ship actually helps move the ship.
Mm. I'm thinking about how the Arts Council really like if you include sort of educational outreach, and I think a lot of us tend to be like, oh, but that I don't know how to do that. I don't know how to make that work. But actually, if I think about all of the projects that I've seen that include children, you know, there was a great I can't remember what it was called at the South London Gallery, a kind of great kids workshop series that took elements from quite complicated shows but broke them down in ways that really young children could understand. Like that felt very positive, and again felt very collaborative in some ways.
I mean, it feels also like an access thing in terms of maybe sometimes when we're talking about art practice as being kind of a sole practitioner who's made the work alone, there's also a sense of no one could possibly understand what I'm going through. You know, as in when we're talking about practices that feel open and you can join in, versus practices that feel closed and you're kind of like admiring from afar sort of the genius, I say in inverted commas. I also am thinking more about that sense of you know, art is always kind of quite a significant way in which we're able to understand ourselves and sort of our place in culture and society. And so those things need to be open, because how are we meant to understand something that's trying to push us away? Mm. You know, in terms of, it doesn't have to be all art is not for all people, obviously, but if you're a public institution in particular and you're doing outreach, it's like, yeah, why should kids not be involved in what contemporary art can be? You know, they're the ones who are going to inherit the arts infrastructure that we're currently kind of continuing on with. So yeah, they should also be given the tools and the ability to engage with it.
Well, I think about some of the marches for Palestine that kids have been doing on Roblox. I'm going to call it video game space, or like a virtual world, a sort of artistic space in some way, and like these sort of gatherings that happen in these spaces
great. That makes me really happy to hear that. I've not seen that. Because I think quite often the rhetoric around these spaces are that they are dehumanizing, they are kind of violent spaces for children to be in, but actually if you give a child a platform, good stuff is going to come out of it, because it's there and the infrastructure is there for them to connect. It's the same kind of rhetoric around social media. Yes, it can be very bad, but so much good has happened within these like collective spaces.
Well, actually, I think I wrote a note of like meme making as like a form of collective practice. Like you can obviously make a meme on your own. That's how people do it. But like the meme language relies on like other memes before it to be able to make sense.
Yeah, or like the remixing of it for it to make sense in your world with your interests. Like, you know, all of the kind of, I love the meme templates where it's just like the images where you can add your own text or yeah, I don't know, but yeah, this kind of like collective knowledge making or collective kind of discussion making through something like a meme.
Yeah.
Is interesting.
But it's like the thing with the meme is you're required to understand what the original image is, and then how the text relates to the image and how that relates to the present. As in, it's requiring that we have a similar maybe knowledge of the present. I was reading an article yesterday, a newspaper article, about what's happening in Iran and with the US and how there's funding currently being spent in Iran. And I'll preface this by saying kind of don't agree with the Iranian government or the Ayatollah, but I think this is quite an interesting way in which they're responding to the violence and aggression of the US, is they're making memes about Trump. The Iranian military has handed over communications to Gen Z and millennials to make memes about Trump. They're using AI Lego films about Trump in order to call him out and make him appear kind of dumb, stupid, incredibly violent, sort of incapacitated, as a way to change the messaging around the war.
I mean, that doesn't surprise me, because the whole, in my head or in my view, like the whole point of memes is to kind of distill something very complex into something that's instantly readable mm-hmm. and instantly understandable. And that's why I don't understand certain memes, because they come from a genealogy of information about, I don't know, FIFA football games or whatever, like comes from things I don't understand. But if you're in that world, you get it instantly without all of this preamble.
Do you think there's something about then whoever can read certain memes that immediately puts them into a specific kind of collective or
totally.
Community of people in terms of, you know, coding to each other? I get this, you get this, we get each other.
Exactly. I mean, it's very dark, because it is a bit Reddit coded or like 4chan coded because they're used in that way. But I do think, there is a kind of like, it's a collective, you're in the know, you're in the group, you're in the in-group, you get what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. It's, they become like these in-jokes to signify the people that are like you. And I think...
It's like also, it's kind of like this weird thing where it's like production and communication, like creative production and communication at the same, operating at the same time.
Maybe then there's a question I want to circle back around to with this mini series, when we're talking about collaboration, where what is the role of the artist, or thinking about the artists that we featured on the show, what are their roles in those collaborative practices? So thinking about, like, if we're talking about memes, for example, obviously there's the original person who has kind of put together this meme, and then there's the person who might, you know, do a spoof of that or do a version of that and so forth. And so kind of the role of the person who's made this first part is kind of quite clear. They are sort of the maker of this object. But as soon as it starts to morph and move and change, their role becomes quite different, like the hierarchy of it breaks down. So I guess how do those roles maybe morph as the collaboration or the collective grows in time? Like, I think Reese is quite an interesting example of this. Like, he started this choir project to sort of figure out how queer sea shanties might look, might act, might feel. And now it's become a project almost independent of him. So his role has changed really drastically. You know, he's gone from the main organizer, the producer, to now founder.
I don't even know if he's the... I mean, he's sort of... The artwork is the catalyst, I feel like, with Reese, rather than him, because he's still part of the group. Like, he's sort of still part of the group. Founder sometimes, I feel like, almost removes the person from it, because I feel like he's very much still part of the group. I don't know.
But I guess as those labels start to break apart.
Yeah.
Like, even when we were talking with Dane about Most Dismal Swamp and what's his role, and he spoke about being, was it creative producer?
Yeah, something like that. I've definitely slipped up with Dane. I've called him just a curator before, and then he's gone, actually, I'm an artist as well. And I've gone like, oh God, sorry, like feeling bad, but he's everything.
Yeah. But those labels start making less and less sense.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think the further down a project you get, especially with somebody like Reese as well, I can imagine a situation where Reese maybe steps aside once this project has gotten bigger, and maybe there's a few different choirs around different port cities, for example, in the UK, where there is not this representation. I can see this project kind of taking on a life of its own without Reese. And I think that's also what's really positive about these collaborations is that they do, as time moves on and they gain momentum, they propel themselves into something else and into something that you might not have even envisioned. Mm. I don't know if I could say the same for Most Dismal Swamp because that is very much linked to Dane. Like Dane is like Dr. Dank to me, like Dr. Swamp. Mm. So it's very much part of his practice and what he's into. But with Reese and maybe even with Emily, I can imagine a situation where these hierarchies, these kind of names given to people within them break down, and it actually is just this one amorphous thing.
It will be. It's with Emily's episode. It's sort of because we've kind of featured it or interacted with it in such early stages. It'll be really interesting to see like how it develops, and like if suddenly like her and her family like doing a bell ringing performance becomes part. Becomes part of the work, or like it'll, because we don't sort of know how it's gonna come together.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, even I'm thinking about the piece I showed on at the beginning of the miniseries and making the original iteration of the work and having a conversation with the curator and being kind of saying, "What's my role in this?" And when you, I guess. Quite often in art school, you're sort of taught more so about authorship because that's also the way in which you kind of you sell and you pitch. And like, yeah, as we were talking about before, you get the grants or the shows or all the things that propel a practice. So when all of a sudden your authorship becomes unimportant, all of that training that you have kind of becomes redundant. Like you need to train again almost in a way. And I think that's maybe part of the precarious thing around collectors is, yes, they're grassroots because they have to be, because you're usually not really taught how to do it. Or like they're often emerging out of, yeah, we said need, but also like immense struggle. Like I remember when we were in Goldsmithina, there was a collective that formed called Black Gold, which was in response to the extreme whiteness of the cohort. I think we had four students of colour in a 60-person cohort. Yeah, it's ridiculous. And when you think about kind of global majority in Lewisham Borough, where Goldsmiths is based, and so that was that collective, and it was more than just those four students who were global majority, but that collective emerged in response to that. So I think there's a thing of the collectives needing to emerge, but then also when you're an artist, kind of your identity becomes such a big part of how you sell a practice. So when that stops being important, you have to completely reframe how practice works for yourself, which I think Dane has done really successfully. Reese has done really successfully. Emily has done really successfully.
And we haven't spoken about your work.
Yeah, we haven't.
It feels like it's slightly a different thing because I think with Dane's practice with Most Dismal Swamp and with Reese's the Seaweed in the Fruit Locker and Emily's work, they're very long research projects in terms of the collaboration and the ways in which they work together. Whereas I think the piece Chanter, you kind of heard it really at the beginning of its life and it's now turning into something new.
So how has your role changed then? If you imagine yourself at the beginning of Chanter, I don't even know how you would have described your role there, but but how has that morphed?
Because I was invited to the residency as an artist, and I think the main way I approached, I didn't even really think about role at the beginning. I more so thought about sensitivity to place, and then that became a way of almost wanting to act as facilitator. And I think there's an interesting thing, for example, with Emily's work, because she's also a producer and works with Shape Arts, so helps to kind of facilitate accessibility and practices and how to support artists who are disabled. Also, I spend a lot of time kind of facilitating a ward in my studio building. So that type of, let's say, more production back end side is quite a comfortable space. So almost like taking that set of tools, learned outside of practice and putting them into practice, into like my art practice for the first time, was interesting. And I think now maybe that's sort of part of how I see the role of almost like there's segments of the project where it's very much I'm facilitator, and then there's segments of the project where I'm very much maker. And it's almost that the way I'm thinking about like the collaboration is I'm very aware that in the case of the project I'm doing, the woman that I'm working with, Bernadette Hayes, like her skill set is her voice and her songwriting and her passion for that and where she lives and how she lives there. I'm not going to ask her to design a piece of sculpture. That makes no sense. That's my skill set. And I think maybe the thing that comes out of working collaboratively or collectively is like you become very aware of the things that you're good at or not. I mean, the other kind of, let's say, non-hierarchical thing that comes from that is kind of I'm part of an artist co-op. And one of the things within that is understanding, oh, this person's really good at PR. This person's really good at making a website. This person knows how to write funding language. This person knows how to cook us all lunch. Or this person knows how to beautifully fill in the holes in the wall of the gallery.
It's like, a skill.
It is. It really is. And I think there's a thing in I think collaborative and collective practices where you become aware of what are the things that you bring into a project and your own skill set much more so, because I think when you're kind of a sole artist making a project alone, you have to do all the things. So even if you're bad at it, you're going to do it.
Mm.
Whereas if you have a group of people that are making the project together, you can pass off the task.
Mm.
It requires more communication, obviously, but it requires more awareness of where your own skill sets lie.
I think that's also quite empowering. Like if I think about our collective, our Future Artifacts collective, if you could call it that, like, yes, we all take part in the discussions, but behind the scenes, we all use the skill sets that we've developed over our careers to kind of really shape the way that Future Artifacts works, I guess. And that it's an empowering thing to be told you're good at this, so you focus on that. You don't have to think about the stuff that you're not good at.
Yeah.
And I guess that's quite addictive in a sense, right?
I think it's that, but then it's also, oh, I want to learn this thing. You know how to do it. Can we learn how to do it together? I think there's a sense of it doing that as well, which I think generally just creates better projects because
you do feel a little bit more brave. When you're working like with someone, sometimes when you're on your own, you're just a bit like I have that as an artist working on my own. Like sometimes I'm just like, what if I can't do it? You can get like afraid by the idea that you might not be able to do it. And actually, weirdly, even if you're with someone next to you who also doesn't know how to do it, it's for some reason is easier. Like when we started the show.
Oh, the first sound edit.
Yeah.
Very first recording we ever did was I was living in a house with a conservatory. So glass. And we just put loads of pillows everywhere and put a mic between us.
On a drum. What were you thinking?
Can't even remember. Yeah, it was completely, and we had no idea, but just the audacity to be like, well, we're both terrible, so it's fine.
Yeah.
And sure, look at us now.
Okay, I've got like a fun fact that I want to finish up with.
Fun fact.
Yeah, I've got a fun fact to finish up with, because I was thinking about the power of like song. So going kind of just like really briefly touching back on the song thing with just a couple of minutes left. So I have seen a lot of videos online of cows.
Cows.
Cows, singing. Like the animal. No, they really love music. So they like, if you play music, like you can find videos on YouTube, on TikTok, on Instagram, of like whatever, like people like singing or like playing an accordion, and the cows in the field suddenly start like they come towards, and then they just stand there and they just listen to the music. And so I was kind of thinking about, I was like, is music or anything like used when like herding animals? Like, is that like something? Because I always like understood like herding animals, like you use dogs and like this. And I kind of went down this rabbit hole basically, and I found this like really ancient practice.
I don't know why, but this is reminding me of the Kentucky meat shower.
Oh,
well, I'm thinking of Well, Peter the Pied Piper.
Yeah, yeah.
Peter Peck.
So there's this practice called kulning, K-U-L-N-I-N-G, and it's a Swedish like
kulning.
And it's almost this like, it's kind of like a little bit like yodeling. But it's like kind of got a bit more of like an elven kind of feel. Like it's a little bit more sing-songy. Like, and there's videos online that you can see like people going into a field and like just singing into a valley. And the whole idea of the song is like the way that you use your voice is that like you do these like kind of upward inflections. So it resonates in the valley so that cows will then come to you.
Was this in The Sound of Music?
I don't think so.
Okay.
Well, also Austria.
Mm. And I like yodeling. Yodeling also, I think, is like, but then I sort of started looking at like hollering and yodeling, like as a form of communication between like vast environments, like where before the telephone or any communicative like device or technology, like that was a way to signal to people like and communicate with them over terrain that maybe like was unsafe to walk through. But then I think also in terms of thinking about like herding animals, like there's this thing of like, you know, if you're herding animals in a huge space, like you have to, if you're doing it with dogs, let's say, which is like a really common way of doing it, there's this idea that you have to, the dog has to be kind of behind the animal. So it's like you're sort of pushing them. And I was thinking about this idea of like the song, rather like you stay stationary and you sing and they come to you rather than like you kind of pushing. And I thought there was something really nice about this power of song as a sort of like attractor or like a, I felt like it was sort of like a more positive way of kind of herding animals. I don't really care about herding animals, but I don't know why I'm talking about this, but now I do.
I mean, it's part of our entire agricultural system, which means we get to eat food. So
yeah, exactly. No, but I just thought there was
a lovely image.
Yeah, and I just kind of thought, I guess, in terms of when we're talking about the power of a song, and we're talking about it in terms of like human to human kind of relationships. I kind of thought like, oh, there's a kind of example of like a song also operating like from human to non-human relationships, and kind of thinking about like what are the where else could song kind of be used, and maybe even like human to objects or humans to technology, or like how could it function? Because it seems to be something that is attractive. But yeah.
It reminds me of the priest that blessed server rooms. Oh, heard about this?
No, I don't know.
Yeah, if you just Google priest blessing server room, like I don't know where they do it. And actually, now I've said it out loud, it might be AI. It might be an AI generated image. But
this like Swaggy Pope.
Yeah. But just thinking about the human and animal relationship, we used to sing to our hamster. We'd sing her the theme tune of Stardew Valley if she was stressed, and it would really calm her down.
Yeah.
So I think this kind of power of it to transcend bodies is really interesting.
There was a really quite a long time ago, Nina and I did a sound event at South Kiosk Gallery in Peckham with artist Maud Craigie around her film Indications of Guilt. And I think we've talked about it quite a bit on the show, because she said something that just really, really struck a chord about how when it's much easier for your brain to perceive inaccuracies in sound than in visual. And I've been thinking more and more about this recently, kind of as someone who's like become more interested in kind of live performance, thinking about kind of the work that I have on the show, those recordings coming from a live performance. And I think there's something about the physicality of sound. So thinking about also with Emily's work and the bell towers and the bell ringing, you know, there's also like, how does that sound exist in a space? And that's not necessarily kind of human to animal, but more so kind of human to room, human to architecture. Kind of the first performance I had of the piece that went on the radio show, Chanter, was in a Templar's Tower. And it's thick walls with no ceiling, but that meant that the sound kind of reverberated really well off the walls of the tower, but also you could hear it outside. which meant that there was this, and I was interested in an old abbey because it was also designed for monks to chant within. So there was also a sense of kind of, how are we responding to our environment with song, with singing? One of the names I put down that I thought about when we were thinking about collaboration earlier and also the non-human is this Irish artist, Dorothy Cross, talks about her practice being in collaboration with nature. And she has this really beautiful film in these that's shot in these caves in Ireland called the Alloway Caves, where she is this young boy, kind of like prepubescent boy, singing underneath a stalactite, the largest one in the country. And it's so long that it sort of ends just above his head. And there's a sense of how his voice then reverberates with the cave, with the mountain. And part of that sense of being able to hear that it's real is the physical nature of the sound. So like, what's the power of the song? Mm. The song is like, how does it move in your body? How does it move in the space? And also thinking about kind of how these cows are responding to the sound through the valley. It's the physical movement of the vibration through the valley.
Through the valley, yeah.
Yeah, I think there's something about that. And like, that's quite different to, I think, like what Dane is talking about maybe in his practice. But I think in terms of what Reese is looking about in terms of the group of voices in a room together, and what Emily's talking about, the group of bell ringers in the tower together, the people in the church listening to the bells, the people in the town. There's like a physical quality to that sound. Like it requires, like the song requires the space and the group. And yes, us as human beings can like identify the words and what they mean, and those types of things. But how it feels in the body, like you don't need to understand the words to understand the feeling.
So I think we're going to have to end there. But I feel like we kind of like, I felt like there was more, as always, there was more to eke out of that conversation. If you haven't already listened to the whole of the, As a Chorus miniseries, you still can. I don't think we've done any spoilers or anything. And yeah, so we have a new upcoming series which will be commissioned by the Henry Moore Institute, but we won't say too much. You'll just have to come back and tune in to the first episode of that miniseries.
Coming to you soon.
Until then, goodbye.
Bye.